Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be enjoying something of a photography special as we meet leading and established talents in the field.
First, we'll be meeting US-based Ben Brody to learn more about his new book, Attention Service Member, which draws on an archive accumulated in his role as combat photographer in the Iraq War.
Then we'll be hearing from Anne Mealy, a MacArthur Fellow whose work explores the tensions between war and the landscape.
And we'll be meeting Giles Price to learn more about how he employs unorthodox mediums to open up a far wider field of vision.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Org, beautiful once again to be spending some quality time here. Sunday, midday, Studio One Midori House. I'd have said the aircon set to a comfortable 19 degrees. It's a pretty decent Sunday.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? It's much less bracing than we've both kind of experienced last week. Anyway,
up in Davos and back down from the mountains. What was your favourite bit of the bit that we saw, at least, of the World Economic Forum?
The bit that we shared?
Yeah.
It's tough. I'm not sure I'm really allowed to say what my favourite bit was because they kind of made me sign a non-disclosure agreement on the way out. We've got an interesting show coming up today.
Yeah?
Yeah, we've got... Today, for no particular reason other than I was compelled to, I've put together quite a nice photography special. We're going to be meeting three really interesting photographers.
Yep.
Their practices overlap, they kind of intersect, but they're all distinct and they all have really, really unique and very strong visual voices. Can you say visual voices?
You can say visual voices. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense, but it's fine. And I think brave to do a photography special on the radio. It's happened before. So what you're basically saying is, reel in your hook, let's haul out the main man, the man with next week's news, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, to enlighten us further. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. There was something in the air that night. The
stars were bright, Fernando. And here he is, resplendent in one of the first T-shirts of the year. We are at the end of January. Lovely to have us with you, Fernando. How have you been?
I've been very well.
And you look exceptionally well.
Oh, thank you very much. I think I still have a little bit of the Brazil tan on me.
Yeah, you're looking good, fresh.
You know my relationship with winter. For me, it's just, you know, I just wait until it goes away.
Suffer through it.
Yeah. I don't even have a winter wardrobe, per se, in a way.
It's a war of attrition, and Fernando always wins.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Thank you.
Yeah.
But next week, to be honest, I think it's quite a good week. Especially, I have a lot of kind of culture stories for you guys. The first one is actually today. It's the Grammy Awards. I mean, we could talk here about the music, who are the nominees, who might win. But I think it's going to be quite an awkward one. Because, as you know, the Grammy chief, she has just been ousted, Deborah Duggan. And she accused the Grammys of so many things. And one of them is corruption. She said even the way they choose the nominees is not quite right. Because it's quite kind of mysterious the way they choose. There's even some rumors, I'm not sure if that's true, that Mariah Carey's album Caution should have been nominated. But apparently it didn't sell very well, so they didn't want to put her there. And it's quite strange because there's been a lot of criticism with the Grammys, especially black performers in the US. They are nominated, but they never win. Even with albums like Lemonade by Beyoncé, which, you know, were acclaimed critically, you know, and sold many copies as well. So it'd be a bit awkward. I wonder how the artists will behave because there's been a lot of gossip around. But I'll still be watching. For sure.
And what are the sort of critical parameters of the Grammys? I mean, are they sales? I mean, do they ever show their workings, the judges? Is it like the Oscars where they just say what they like?
I think it's much more mysterious than the Oscars. I think the Oscars, to be fair with them, they've been quite open. They wanted to have a more kind of diverse number of people that vote for them. And I think the Grammys is still, perhaps they will have like what the Oscars had 2 years ago in the coming years, especially with this big scandal happening. But I have to say, I like the nominees this year. I think it's quite an interesting year. I have a personal favorite for Album of the Year. I think Lana Del Rey with Norman fucking Rockwell, I think she deserves to win this year. Do you have a particular favorite this year, guys?
I don't actually know what the nominees are. I mean, that's definitely a good record. Norman F. Rockwell, Who knew that that was his middle name?
You are more polite than me, Rob,
wholesome,
actually.
Wholesome American illustrator.
Exactly.
I don't really know what else is on the menu, but I'll take that one.
What have we got next?
Next, well, officially was yesterday, the Chinese New Year, but this is the first week of the New Year, the Year of the Rat. And of course, I kind of, don't worry, I'm not going to review which year you guys were born, but I know...
It's all right.
It's all right, right? The
Year of the Rat. I love that. Sounds like a sort of Frederick Forsyth novel.
If you don't mind, I have a few predictions for each one of our animals. Yeah. Perhaps I'll start with Og, because he's a horse. It's just a little phrase for you. Your mindset and attitude are important this year, as people with this sign are in for a challenging year ahead. Be prepared for unexpected changes this year, so you have to put an extra effort to achieve your goals, rein in your impulse to spend money endlessly.
I feel like my kind of conscience has been externalized and is speaking back to me.
Keep that in mind, okay, because that's the first day of the year. And Rob, you're a snake, right?
I think I'm a snake, yeah.
Well, let's see what I have to say for you. Your good luck will come in the form of new relationships. Pay attention to your personal belongings, as there are potential chances for theft and robbery. Your reputation could also be at risk. So be mindful of your words and behavior.
Oh, my God. Okay? Sounds like
it's all changed for you in 2020, isn't it?
Luckily, I kept that profile open on the dating app.
What did you get, Faye?
I'm Tiger. Let's see. Mine's quite a good one. There's a potential for you to travel this year for career or education purposes. Take this time to get to know new people and expand your horizons. Pay close attention to your health and think twice before indulging in the latest food fad. I'm not worried. I don't like food
specific,
fad.
Your one.
Yeah.
Yours had an air of menace about it, didn't it, Rob?
Yeah, it's like...
Just be careful with robberies, okay?
Slightly different tone.
It's a bit keep yourself to yourself,
Bobby. Mind your own.
Keep yourself...
Have you got one more for us,
mate? One more. I mean, this is a very personal story for me, but, well, Madonna's coming to London for the Madame X tour, and I'll be going, actually, with our fellow colleague, Marcus, next Thursday. But the thing is, I mean, I don't know if you heard, apparently she's been injured. She's been cancelling quite a few shows because she might need a hip replacement or something like that. That.
Wow. I mean, but, how the mighty fall.
But I'm glad I like Madonna because she's, you know, she fights for it. She's not someone that would stop singing just because of blood injury. So, you know, I'm very happy about that. Do you have a first gig of the year already? Before talking about those things.
I've got nothing booked, but I'd love to see one of the bands that have come out of sort of Sons of Kemet, that kind of London jazz thing. I'm kind of into that at the moment, so anything that pops up.
That sounds nice. I'm going to go to Imagining Ireland, which we've already spoken to someone about.
Yeah.
That's in about a month's time. Hopefully we'll have one of the organisers coming in to give us a kind of fuller debrief closer to it, because it is a really good event. Faye, I'm surprised that you've only got one night booked at Madonna's residency, if I'm honest.
To be fair, I might have two.
That's more like
also, what I want to see more than Madonna is you and Marcus seeing Madonna. I love the pair of you, and I just so want to see. I want that to be a short documentary or a long one.
Unfortunately, no pictures allowed. Apparently, you have to leave your mobile at reception.
So, where is she playing?
At the London Palladium. So it's slightly smaller. Great. So I think it'll be very intimate. And I'm glad there's no mobile.
You know what happens at the London Palladium? Last time I went to a gig there, you're greeted in the old-fashioned style by men in white frock coats, and it's all really lovely. It's super cool.
That's very cool. I'm envious.
So I bet you should be into that.
Faye, thank you so much for joining us once again for that really lovely news look ahead. You, listener at home, are listening to the Monocle Weekly. In just a moment, we'll be hearing about life as a combat photographer from Ben Brody.
The war in Iraq is a conflict that hasn't ever really gone away. In the almost two decades since the US spearheaded an invasion to topple Saddam Hussein, the country has rarely been out of the news, the war's legacy of trauma still echoing.
Ben Brody joined the US military in 2002 with one aim, to capture the war on camera, firsthand. As a combat photographer, Brody found his work censored by the military. The institution wasn't interested in thousand-yard stares, only gloss to be repurposed as propaganda.
With his first book, Attention, Service Member, Brody's returned to his archive. Along with personal essays, the images offer an incredible, subjective take on a war and the way its trauma continues to affect not just Iraq, but the people who fought there as well.
I caught up with Ben a little earlier to find out more. Ben, thank you so much for joining me on the Monocle Weekly, and congratulations on Attention Service Member. It's a very special book, personal document, it feels like, but also a portrait of one of the epoch-defining wars of our age. Could you just give me a little bit of background on how you kind of arrived in Iraq in 2003?
When you say generation-defining epoch, I had no idea, of course, back in 2002 that it would be such a thing. But my only sort of experience with war stories was from my parents' generation with the Vietnam War. So when it became clear that the U.S. was going to invade Iraq on dubious evidence, it piqued my interest in that way. Like, maybe this will be this generation-defining war, and I should photograph it. I should be there to see it. But, of course, I was 22 years old and had no money and no experience as a photojournalist. So the only option I thought was available to me was to join the Army as a combat photographer. I enlisted in late 2002 and was sent to the 3rd Infantry Division. Yeah, while I was in the military, I was assigned to make visual propaganda extolling the virtues of the war. And in my 6 years in the Army, I spent 2.5 years in Iraq.
What you were hired to make was visual propaganda, or what your role was visual propaganda. And this book is comprised of photographs that don't fit that. These don't paint particularly romantic picture of war. They're honest, basically. They're frank. You know, one of my favourites in the book is of two soldiers enjoying this actually very delicious looking meal, and one of them is just completely glazed. People talk about a 1,000-yard stare. But you weren't allowed to use those photos in your capacity as a military photographer, were you? So what are these images drawn from?
These images are drawn from what we call my raw take. The raw take refers to every photograph I ever made, which I saved from Iraq, which in 2.5 years of working there comprises about 25,000 images. So the images of mine that were actually released in press releases for public consumption probably number in the several hundred. So it was a much larger body of work that I was drawing from for this book. And it was actually a body of work that I left completely untouched on a hard drive for about 10 years before I revisited it and felt like that could form the basis of a book about my experiences photographing the wars for 15 years as both a soldier and a civilian.
What's really powerful about it is that it's a very personal, it's quite a subjective perspective here. Revisiting that hard drive must have been quite a difficult thing to do, but I wondered how much you saw when you were going through the images and when you were putting this book together, your deployment as your real education in photography. Could you look back and recognize in the images yourself learning?
Absolutely. I think that's sort of an interesting layer of the book, is how my visual approach and the different visual strategies I've used to try and communicate the war have shifted over 15 years. And even when I was working in Afghanistan as a civilian, as a very self-aware and sophisticated photojournalist, I'm still wrestling with the visual language of photojournalism and trying to make images that sort of challenge what people expect pictures of war in Afghanistan to look like. And some of that comes from the visual style itself. One thing that photojournalists have always had to grapple with in covering the modern wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Arab Spring is the unbelievable proliferation of the number of images that people are exposed to every day. So during the Vietnam War, for example, you had these incredibly powerful images like Nick Ut's picture of Kim Phuc, the girl burned with napalm, or Eddie Adams's photograph of the execution in Saigon that really changed public opinion. And the only photographs from Iraq or Afghanistan that really functioned in that way were the Abu Ghraib photographs, which were not made by photojournalists. They were made by soldiers who were committing war crimes and torturing detainees and making these boastful photographs about it. So there's something about that subjective vernacular visual language that I really wanted to get at. So when editing 25,000 images from Iraq and 50,000 images from Afghanistan, that was very much in my mind, as sort of finding that subjectivity.
That idea that the proliferation of images has changed our relationship to them and made it harder to produce one that can really capture the imagination is something that I wanted to pick up on, because there are a couple of pictures in this book and some very interesting pages where you've reverse image searched a photograph that you've taken. Because you were in the army, all of your photographs that were published in that capacity or in the public domain, which means that anyone has been able to use any of your images from that time as they see fit. And you discovered that some of them have been put to these very strange uses. One photograph that you talk about and discuss the sense memory of taking has been repurposed as an advert for vape pens, for example. And I wondered, what did that do for you in terms not only of how you understand the currency of images, but in terms of, you know, your own experience? What did it feel like to see a picture taken under those circumstances and in that context, arguably cheapened, repurposed in this way for a mass audience as a promotional tool?
Of course, it's really shocking to come across a photograph that you do have this intense sense memory of making, and to see it totally divorced from that context and reappropriated in some sort of tawdry commercial purpose. That said, the photograph in question is probably my most successful piece of military propaganda. You know, it's this beautiful photograph of the light coming through the tree line as soldiers dash between trenches and a captain speaks on his radio leading soldiers through a firefight. It's exactly what we expect photography to do for war, to glorify it, to, you know, make it seem like a grand adventure. You know, so it wasn't surprising to me that that photograph really grew legs and proliferated in the way that free imagery does in this day and age. But it's still the experience of sitting at my computer, like, researching about lithium batteries for this crazy, like, electric motorcycle project I'm working on, and just coming across this image that makes me smell the anise from that field and the cordite from the gunpowder. As I wrote in the book, the little girl screaming in the house that we finally broke into.
What do you think it says about America and its relationship to the military?
So I think America lionizes the military in a way that is often counterproductive. I mean, sort of the classic example is, like, I went to the hardware store the other day and saw, like, a veteran parking only parking space. And it just seemed to me like, well, what are they saying? Like, what I learned in the military is I need to be treated differently from everyone else, and I can't find a parking space on my own. But, you know, it comes from a good place, I think. But what I really wanted to say about American culture in my book is not so much about that lionization or fetishization, really, but about our relationship to facts in the media. My role as a propaganda photographer in Iraq meant that I was sort of front and center in portraying the war in a false light. Not that I believed at the time that anyone reading my obviously one-sided press releases would believe me, but I think that normalization of official falsehoods or official oversimplification of really important facts has had a tremendous effect on our culture. And, you know, now we find ourselves in this post-truth environment helmed by Donald Trump, where he's leading rallies. People are aggressively shouting at the media, where journalists are being killed and threatened and kidnapped at a much higher rate than before. And I really think there is a lot to learn from the so-called global war on terror when it comes to addressing the roots of that aspect of our current culture.
To go back to the book itself, as you said to me over email when we were talking about arranging this interview, it's a very tactile object. There's different paper stocks. It's a compact but very heavy, I don't know about self-consciously, but it's got a kind of willfully understated or utilitarian cardboard cover. It also opens with these black and white images. They bookend the central part in which the images of war are bound. And I wanted to ask about that decision. What's the story behind these black and white pictures, and why do they frame these images of conflict?
In setting out to make this book, I wanted to do something that I felt like hadn't been done before in photo books. The idea was not to create an object which contains all my best pictures, and it was not to create a document that attempts to explain these wars in sort of a straightforward way. What I wanted to do is really sort of convey my own experiences with the disorienting and corrosive effects of war itself. And I think to communicate that, I decided that the book needed to be really personal and from a single perspective, my perspective. So the black and white photographs are of my life at home in rural Massachusetts. They're of people I love. And the photographs are made in such a way where you can sort of sense an undercurrent of menace and threat. The world looks different when you've spent your entire adult life and some of your boyhood at war. And I wanted to convey that visually. So yeah, that's what the black and white work is about.
On that note of disorientation and the corrosive effects of conflict, obviously, you didn't sign up for maybe the more normal kind of quasi-jingoistic reasons that young men sometimes join the military, although there was still a kind of maybe a degree of bravado or sort of naivety to your decision to enlist. But maybe that also inoculated you from some of the disaffection that the cliched veteran comes back from war with, certainly from the war that was your kind of cultural influence, the Vietnam War. I'm saying, I guess, that maybe you had less of a stake in it in terms of your relationship to the country that was sending you there. But when you kind of realized the tension between the images that you were making for the military as propaganda and what was really there, and the way that those former set of images could be recontextualized to tell a narrative that was at best duplicitous and at worst outright incorrect or a lie, did that exacerbate that kind of disorientation on your return?
So definitely my experiences with PTSD, I think, come more from head injuries and, you know, being sort of traumatized by violence rather than the sort of cultural and ideological whiplash that some soldiers have felt. I certainly wouldn't want to generalize and say most soldiers joined for these like sort of jingoistic reasons. I think that's actually in the minority. But among those soldiers, it was very difficult to process the reality of what the war was, I think. So yeah, I was insulated from that somewhat by my sort of ingrained cultural skepticism of the typical New Englander. But I do think that PTSD is not something that is necessarily like a response to, you know, cultural change or having your worldview upended. It's, you know, a physical response to these sort of high intensity, high adrenaline situations. It rebuilds your chemistry. But at the same time, getting hit in the head a lot, which is just something that's going to happen if you're outside the wire for a long time, that has really similar symptoms to PTSD. And while I'm certainly not a neurologist or a psychiatrist, I've tried to, you know, describe what that experience feels like visually. You know, there are no captions in the book because I don't want to provide this like misleading context. I want you to feel that disorientation. I want you to feel that sort of atmosphere of menace using the medium of a photo book.
Has communicating all that served to put anything kind of to rest for you? Has it drawn a line under anything?
Making a photo book is really difficult. So obviously I was stomping around in minefields for 13 or 14 years, providing the, you know, the work for the book. And I was conceptualizing the book for 2 years. And then I spent a year scrutinizing every detail of the production. So making the book was exhausting. But people's reactions to the book and hearing people having these good experience with it and people being moved by the book, that really has been incredibly redemptive for me. And yeah, it was a great experience that I did not expect in making Attention Service Member.
Thanks to Ben Brody, and Attention Service Member is available now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Welcome back to this special photography-focused episode of the Monocle Weekly. We just heard from a photographer whose career was founded in conflict. Our next guest has made her career from exploring its effects upon the landscape.
Anne Mai Lee arrived in the US as a refugee from the Vietnam War. Her career as a photographer has seen her return to the conflict through reenactments conducted in North Carolina. She's been embedded with the US Navy and revisited the war-ravaged landscapes of her childhood home to find them restored.
At the heart of her practice is the interrogation of the presence of war, its apparatus and its participants on the landscape. How within conflict, the world can become a theatre.
Last week, Anne Mai was in London for the opening of her new exhibition at the Marion Goodman Gallery, and I went along to find out more.
Thank you very much for your time this morning. Downstairs here at the gallery, you're focused on the United States, and especially with the border with Mexico as well, but you spend a lot of time in Louisiana. And I wanted to ask you about the catalyst for your work in Louisiana.
The project started in 2015. So much was happening in the United States. I think there was the rise of a nationalist movement leading up to the elections. There were many ideas thrown around in a very simplistic black and white fashion that was very upsetting. There were breaches or talks of breaches to the Constitution. There was a lot of unsettling ideas and unsettling events that happened that pushed me to try to make work to respond to what was going on. I felt that actual war was coming to the home front. This coincided with an invitation I received to a photograph on the set of this big budget Hollywood film called Free State of Jones, also with the controversy surrounding the Confederate monuments, the removal of the Confederate monuments. This was all happening. The film set was being filmed in Louisiana, and the Confederate monuments that I was focused on were in New Orleans, and so that brought me to work for quite some time in New Orleans, starting in 2015.
And it's a state of the United States that is well known for having a troubled, rich history. Your work seems to focus on a lot of the myth and myth-making that has gone on through hundreds of years. As you say, you look at these statues of Beauregard and Robert E. Lee, and then you're on the film set with something that is people pretending to be at war, at least. Do you draw parallels between those two things specifically, or do you let your sort of work speak for itself on that level?
Well, I would like to let my work speak for itself.
But sadly, I've asked you the question.
Yes, but I think that the film set and the monuments, or the controversies around the monuments, are there as a way to open up the subject and to connect moments in history and a continuing controversy with what was happening in real time. I think it was my way to try to speak about current events in a way that was complicated.
And on that sort of that idea of the immigration story, the migration and immigration story, on one wall downstairs you have two pictures that are about the landscape, but about people in the landscape. On the right-hand side you have a shot, I think it's in Marfa in Texas, with dudes in Stetsons on horseback, and it's very much the sort of Marlboro Man kind of identity.
Absolutely.
To that, which I guess is
Prince, the Richard Prince reference.
Yeah. Yeah. And then on the left-hand side of that wall, you have migrant workers, looks like they're weed-killing crops, hunched over, they're dressed very differently, they're not dressed like frontiersmen or cowboys. And you draw the difference in much of your work, it seems, in this show, between the myth of the West or the myth of America and the actuality of it. Did you have to look very hard to find these differences?
That's why it's so extraordinary, because they are actual working ranchers. They were about to go rounding the cattle, and I managed to be taken with them, and so it's their daily work, and there was nothing cinematic, nothing posing about it. It was just men at work, and I respected that, and I admire the idea of labor and that sort of care. But I think in the work, I really tried to show that the myth still, if we call it a myth, it still exists, and I'm wowed by it and completely seduced by it. But at the same time, I also wanted to burst the bubble.
And I suppose people wearing, it's a kind of indigenous uniform for that kind of job. It's practical.
Yeah, no, it's not a costume.
Yeah.
It's the work uniform, yes. The reason why you wear the Stetsons is because you need to guide the horse, and the hat makes complete sense. You need to be able to see, but you need also some shade. And yeah, it's completely practical clothing.
But it's funny, I suppose, also looking at this at a show in London, people would look at it differently if they were Texans or Americans. You kind of feel that there is an element of myth-making simply in the uniform there. And then you look at soldiers dressed up in Confederate or Civil War army costumes, and they are costumes there, they're not uniforms, I suppose, faking a war for a war film. There are a few parallels that are nicely loose, I suppose, in this show. Did you keep them nice and loose on purpose?
I think that's my interest, is to just tie what is real and what is not real and make you fall in love with something, but then in the next step bring you to question what you just fell in love with. And I hope to continue doing that with my work. I'm not interested in something that's very straightforward.
It's sort of summed up, I suppose, by one of the pictures. It's such a wonderful photograph of statues of Generals Lee and Beauregard. They've been taken off their perches, kind of literally, and they're wooden shed, a temporary storage facility during this. This was after the Charlestown church shooting, I guess. How did you get into there? Because access is kind of an interesting kind of question. How did you sniff out this particular place? Or was it just standing on the side of a highway and you could snick in and shoot it?
Well, access is obviously part of the work. I would not be able to make so much of it without the access, but I don't think it makes the pictures any better, or the pictures are good despite the access. That was actually a very easy picture to have access to. A friend knew someone in the office of the mayor and sort of made a pitch for me. It happened very easily.
And elsewhere in the US, we've talked about Louisiana. You're also in Montana and you're in various places. Again, you mentioned these predominantly male photographers that for whom the American road trip was a sort of rite of passage. Why was it a male thing? Is it simply the politics of the time, the gender politics of the time? Is it a male obsession, or is it simply the fact that they had the ability to get in a car and go everywhere?
It just seemed that they had the freedom to do it at the time and the idea to do it. And I don't know. I think it seems, I don't want to generalize, but there's this vague idea that perhaps women were working closer to home because, you know, they had children and they photographed their children and they didn't really travel that much, which is not true. Or maybe those types of works were celebrated versus someone else. And I must say that Justine Kurland, a young photographer, has been traveling the United States for a long time with her son. And I would say that she does the American road trip too and has been doing it for quite a while. So we should mention her. Oh, can we talk about the fetishizing of the uniform? Yeah. I mean, that's certainly...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the dressing up box that you bring to the...
Yeah, so that is certainly something that is on my mind. And I think some people have asked whether I actually fetishize the military and the gear and all of this. You know, it's something that is interesting to me. I certainly don't think I do it. And so I think one way to sort of undercut that is to actually show costumes versus actual practical uniforms, yes.
Yeah, because it is interesting. When we talked about that in one of your earlier answers, the difference between the costume and the uniform. Good costume would be almost as good quality, maybe in some cases better made. I'm sure certainly in the Civil War era, a costume made these days would be better quality than uniform in those days. When you're asked about the fetishization of uniform or costume, military wear, does that worry you? What's that trigger in you? Does it undermine your work somehow? What do you?
I don't think so. I think it's a complete misunderstanding, and I think it stems also from the fact that people are at times frustrated. Some people are frustrated by the fact that I don't have a very clear stand, or I don't show a very clear stand. Are you for or against the war? What do you think of the military? And because of my background, because of what the military had done in Vietnam, while at the same time had saved my life as a teenager, you know, I have very conflicted feelings about many institutions. So I wanted to bring that conflict into my exploration of the topic, and I think things are not that simple. So there are things that are positive that I'm drawn to, and there are things that I disagree with, and I would like to continue exploring the subject matter with those shades. And I think it makes a lot of people uncomfortable.
Yeah, so do people always want you to be definitive? Do people always want to be able to look at one of your pictures and say, she thinks this, and I get it, and that's, I put her in this box.
She went through the war, and she is against war.
It makes you easier for people to pigeonhole or...
I am. I think ultimately we should try to avoid war as much as possible, but it's much more complicated than that. So I am willing to explore a topic that's large, that I think is larger than, that is ambitious. And I'm willing to explore it in a complicated way. I'm not afraid of trying to deal with something and reducing the results.
Are you interested, I wonder, in guerrilla fighters who don't wear a sort of the codified device of a military uniform, but whose kind of casual wear, as you would call it, aspires occasionally to the status of a uniform, but it's much less easy to and perhaps understand the intention, or maybe it's not. Maybe the kind of guerrilla fighter with his scarf and his bandana and his, maybe that is as codified a uniform as the actual military uniform. But are you interested in the sort of less delineated types of fighting wear, I wonder?
Well, I think I would be, but the Marines and the sailors are more connected to my personal history, yeah, in terms of the Vietnam War. So that's my instinct, is to go to them first.
When we walk up the stairs here at the gallery, we see some of your earlier work. It's called 29 Palms, or it's from a collection called 29 Palms. And this, again, seems to me to be part of the myth-making of the military. It's the US Army on manoeuvres, on practice manoeuvres in the Mojave Desert. Now, there's some good kind of hardware and uniform shots up here. These are obviously different subject matters, but how do these two sort of sit together on different floors of this gallery?
I think they both relate to conflict. They both have to do with landscape and scale, and they also have to do with the myth-making. I think upstairs in 29 Palms, this is unfolding in the landscape that was actually photographed by Timothy O'Sullivan at the turn of the century when he explored the West. It's also the landscape that was used during the Vietnam War. There were specific villages that were built in Georgia and elsewhere in the south of the United States, but the Marines were training for Vietnam on this particular landscape. And of course, I think a lot of the pictures feel like they were taken in the back lot of a Hollywood film, where it seems like, you know, the back of some houses and this fighting going on. The language is also very similar in terms of what you find on the film set, with the reenactments, or here with real trainings of Marines. They talk about scenarios, they talk about theater of operations, they talk about a script, actors. So some of the civilian contractors who are working on some of the trainings are called actors.
Yeah, it's really strange. And here in 29 Palms, they're dressed up, they're practicing for Iraqi and Afghani maneuvers, and they're dressed up as Afghans or Arabs, you know, in robes and things. I didn't realize it was down to that level of, almost to me, slightly creepy detail.
Yes, well, I think the whole point is to try to replicate something that is as real as possible to prepare the soldier for any eventuality. This was at the beginning of the war, so it was still very slapdashed and put together at the last minute, and that's why you see all the graffiti on some abandoned housing. Eventually, the military built minarets and markets, had speakers broadcasting prayers at the right time. And so it became much, much more intricate.
It's mad and amazing and sort of unsurprising, but it is nuts. And just on a personal note, are you able to trace, you mentioned it in one of your earlier answers, trace your interest in this right back to your childhood and, as you say, seeing the American military in Vietnam and then, as you say, having your life almost saved by them?
This project started because I was extremely unnerved when we invaded Iraq in 2003. And this was my response, and was to try to be there somehow. I was not able to be in Iraq itself. And I thought that this would be an interesting place, and I think it was the perfect place for me because I was able to actually come in contact with these young men and women who's, you know, it broke my heart to think about them going off to war and this idea of another Vietnam or this idea of have we learned any lessons? You know, obviously we were taking the risk of entering another Vietnam. And so I immediately thought of the young men and women who were going off to war. So this was a place to meet them before they were going off. And at this time, most of them had not gone yet. So they were really newbies. And so it's not that it was an inevitability to it, but we're sort of at the precipice. So perhaps something could happen and they would not be sent. And so it was important for me to come in contact with them at the time. It was also the first moment where I actually got into conversations with some and understood what it meant to join the military. Many of them do it for combatant reasons, this feeling they always knew they wanted to be in a combat situation. But most of them signed up for economic reasons. They didn't have jobs. This was a way to get a job. They had never traveled outside of the States, and this really opened their life to other opportunities. But they had to give up their rights to choice and follow anything that any American foreign policy decisions. So it's an interesting position for them to be, and I think it made me much more empathetic to what it means to be in the military. I was also able to make a distinction between the individual versus the decision makers in D.C. who decide to go to war and the repercussions of their decisions, you know, going all the way down to the soldier, to the civilians in Iraq, et cetera.
And just finally, on a sort of more of a purely photographic note, some of your pictures downstairs sort of remind me of people bathing in a river, and it kind of seems like a sort of riverbank food and drink. It feels like a little festival. Reminds me of like Renoir painting. When you took those pictures of people kind of at rest, enjoying themselves on the weekend, did people want to always know where their pictures are going to end up, where their portraits are going to end up? How much did you need to feel the need to tell them about the context of the work that you were making at the time?
I usually don't give any too many details because I don't know whether the picture is going to work or anything like that. So I just ask, well, you know, will you pose for me? Or I just say, oh, you look so wonderful, can I take a picture? It's as simple as that. And sometimes I even forget to ask for a model release.
Thank you very much indeed for your time.
My thanks to Anne Mylay, and her new exhibition, Silent General, is open at the Marion Goodman Gallery until the end of February. You are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, and if you're just joining us, today we're enjoying a photography special, sitting down with three leading practitioners to find out more about their lives and practice. Now that it's been around for quite a while, it's hard to call photography a new medium. But beyond subject matter and composition, there are still photographers pushing the vanguard of image making using emergent technologies.
From Richard Moss, whose infrared images of conflict in the Congo catapulted him into the spotlight, to Trevor Paglen, a one-time weekly guest who documents the apparatus of mass surveillance with its own toolkit. A generation of photographers and artists are using methods of image making that serve to reveal new truths previously hidden from the eye and mind.
Giles Price is a photographer whose work explores the social impact of cultural and political phenomena. For his latest project, collected in a book called Restricted Residence, he went to Japan using thermographic imaging technology to explore the experience of residents returning to towns rendered dangerous by the Fukushima disaster.
Giles, join me in the studio to talk a little bit more about the book.
Well, my starting point was for the previous two Olympics, I've made work about the sort of social, economic and sort of political impact of Olympics arriving in countries and cities. Actually, starting at London, I was living very close to the Olympic side at the time. And the IOC plus LOCOG, who were the sort of UK organisers, had actually placed these really draconian laws in about who could actually take pictures of the site or around the site. So I'd started actually making a piece of work about this sort of restricted border fence area, of which by default I couldn't see much through. And then doing a bit more research into that, I found that actually the airspace over the site, it's the main air routes into Heathrow and City of London Airport, and there was no restrictions on the airspace. Actually, a friend of mine who lived actually in Hackney Wick, very close to the site, knew a local firm who needed some aerial footage taking. So we used that as an opportunity to pay for us to get into the air and then shot the construction, the vast, you know, development change which was happening to that part of London at that time. So that started the very initial sort of interest in sort of impact of Olympics as such. And that piece of work actually continued on, although it started with these sort of very abstract, sort of high-res Google Earth. I mean, I was very influenced, having a sort of background in the military and loving sort of maps and cartography. I was very interested in Google Earth at the time, which was still quite new back in sort of 08, 09. But of course, the upload speeds of that and the resolution was, you know, very low. So that initially was the sort of interest in how I then approached that from the air.
So then you arrived at Japan, which is the kind of the backdrop for your latest photo book. Japan is somewhere that maybe has got its, or definitely has got its issues, but it's not necessarily somewhere that you immediately associate with kind of rank inequality or necessarily like really endemic corruption. It's kind of, broadly speaking, we think of it as a pretty stable, pretty well-developed country. And you chose to focus on these two towns that had been hit by the terrible tsunami. So were you looking for something that sort of maybe made sense in the narrative of your photography practice to kind of land on in Japan? Or was it more of a kind of serendipitous thing?
It was more driven by actually a look at that cycle coming on and being that I'd ended up shooting these last two sort of pieces of work about the impact of the Olympics and the sort of wider ramifications of holding Olympics. There's a handful of games actually being played in Fukushima City, which is 80 kilometres away from the reactor. And this is part of that, you know, show of, you know, we're dealing with this and cleaning it up. So that was my sort of interest point. And I was interested where, you know, there is this big wide debate going, should these areas be opened up? Should people be incentivized or allowed to return? And this started happening in 2017. That was my sort of interest point. And I was interested in how this landscape has both visually changed through the destruction of the earthquake and the tsunami, but also the sort of unseen and the perception that we have within the unseen notion of radiation and that change where, so, you know, this is a landscape where everyone goes, OK, that's different. That's been altered to what it was. And my own practice leading on from having done a lot of or having incorporated a lot of aerial work into my documentary practice was the arrival of drone technology and how drone technology has massively advanced, especially in the last few years. And within that, the sort of capabilities that drones bring to that, one of these being thermal. So this was something that I started to sort of play with and it interested me within a drone capacity. And when it came to sort of thinking about this altered environment, it was very much the sort of abstractness of it and the colours. You know, there's nothing scientific I'm using this technology for, although there are sort of loose sort of conceptual sort of tie-ins. So, you know, this technology is used in industrial surveying for sort of leaks and spillages. It's also used in medicine for sort of screening illnesses and diseases. So that was sort of my entry point. And at the start, I was using this technology, which is designed actually for very close to very near distance sort of imaging of basically industry or people. So I had no way of knowing what it would render within a landscape, which makes up quite a large part of the book. And because this technology, it shoots a traditional photograph at the same time as it's shooting a thermal image. Initially, I was interested in possibly using a sort of diptych of the two. But it was only when I sort of got back and got stuck into the edit that, A, that became quite a sort of static approach. And secondly, the sort of immersive intensity of just existing in this very altered world had a real sort of resonance to it.
Well, it really does. And I mean, as you say, it's the kind of invisible threat of radiation that makes it scary, isn't it? That's the thing. It's this kind of menacing presence. It's like a haunting. And this new medium, it's not necessarily that new, thermal imaging, but it's an unconventional one in photography. It does communicate this sort of essence of menace or unsettledness, unsettled quality of the place. How much time did you spend in Namie and Itate, which are the two towns that you profile in this book? And how close did you become to the residents there?
I made two trips from sort of late 2017 and start of 2018. And of course, you know, just Japan anyway is tricky for someone who doesn't speak Japanese, and especially sort of rural Japan, which this is. So I had an interpreter. So that was my interaction to actually interact with the people of these towns. Each trip was about sort of 5 days. And like with these pieces of work, as I was saying, you go in there and I didn't necessarily know, even sort of visually, the outcome of it. And as in any sort of piece of work, the further you get into it, the more by default you start to find and discover within that this notion of radiophobia, which is Fred Pierce, who writes the essay in the middle of the book, discusses this. And this is this scientific term to the fear of radiation, that fear of the unknown. And the people of these towns were an interesting mix of, you know, a lot of older people had moved back. There were less families there. And of course, there were people that a lot of the subsidies that had been given to the evacuees had started to be cut at this point. So there was an aspect of sort of, you know, Japanese government sort of forcing people back with incentives of new homes and these sort of things. There were a couple of people I met who weren't even from there and had literally turned up as an opportunity. So within that whole, you know, gamut of people there, there was an interesting selection of this, you know, these few hundred people that moved back into these two towns, which initially had a populations of 27,000. And then the use of the technology, you know, strips away identity. That then became quite interesting within to have sort of broader conversations. Because like I said, there is nothing scientific. I'm not applying that any particular individual in here has any mental health or physical health problems. But the research and the science on that wider level states that this is a wide issue applied to these people in these areas. So that became actually a very interesting way of trying to open that conversation up. And also the notion of sort of stigmatisation, especially there is in Japan against people or against people from this sort of area. So within that, it allowed this anonymity to then try and have a conversation that actually it's a mental health problem, the immediacy and now, more so than actually the sort of physical aspect of it.
I was going to say, there's something very lonely about the pictures, you know, that the way the thermoimaging kind of renders figures alone against a green background, people's heat signatures show up so they're very red, and then the background is cooler colours and they stand out. A lot of them are shot sort of individually, although there are groups. And there's a lot of space. There's this very compelling picture of a group of people working in the middle of an office, and it almost looks as though round the edges there's desk space for, as you say, the other 27,000 or inhabitants who've left or who've perished. Did it have a strange feeling, these towns? Like, did they feel empty?
Yes. And actually, that's where the sort of design of the book and Loose Joints, the publishers, did such an amazing edit and design with it, because they've designed it actually in a sort of circular fashion. So you come in through these desolate landscapes with nobody in it, and suddenly the human figures start to arrive and they build up to the type portraits in the middle, where you then have Fred's text about the psychological aspects of this, and then it flows back out again. So you get this notion of this altered place and these minority of people in it. And it very much felt that way. You know, Japan is immaculate. You know, the Japanese and the culture, their environment, the synergy that they have with their environment, well, there's a total understanding about that. Once you get into the exclusion zone, you drive down the 114, which is this road that they reopened, which drives right through the middle of the most highly radioactive areas. Suddenly, everything's destroyed and there's weeds growing out of everything. So when you get into Itate and Namie, there's this sort of balance within that. Some of it is immaculate and certain people have turned up and are sort of getting on with life. And then next to it, there'll be a totally destroyed, ruined house with plants and weeds coming out of it. So it's very much this sort of contrast between those two.
This kind of practice of using different photographic mediums, different film stocks to kind of add this narrative depth to your work, how are you kind of taking that forward? Are you sticking with the thermoimaging on your next project, or are you going for experimenting with different media? And is that something that you kind of do regularly, or does it kind of happen in the way that you described with the aerial photos and the Google Maps?
I think for the last decade, 12 years, my work has started to shift more into the sort of conceptual. And I think partly that is a reaction that actually, you know, photographic practitioners are having to deal with, in that they're just the overload of imagery. You know, I read somewhere the other day that in 2015, more images were made in 2015 than the entire history of photography up until that point. You know, the wider backdrop of where we are in the world now with technology. Technology is massively emotive, whether it's social media and Twitter and people, you know, technology is making us more emotive. What I found interesting about these images was actually that, you know, that's the immersive aspect of it. They are emotive. The sort of mundanity of most of these images of day-to-day life and the sort of the colours and then that notion that actually these people could be living in an environment that is potentially harmful physically or mentally becomes the interesting shift point. It's not that, oh, this is a thermal, what does that particular spot heat? As I was saying, it's trying to find that place where it's not just something that's been designed for science, trying to just, you know, reference something in a scientific way. How does it evolve into a, you know, visual practice and uses outside of that?
Thanks to Giles Price, and Restricted Residence is out now, published by Loose Joints. And that's it, Org. Your photography special was wonderful.
I think it was really good. I particularly enjoyed your chat from the Marion Goodman Gallery. I cannot wait to go and see that exhibition.
Yeah, it's a wonderful show. And yeah, it's kind of nice. Sounds like a funny thing to say. MLA is obviously an amazing photographer. It's great work. It's thought-provoking. It's deep and rich and all the rest of it. But I love this period of the year in big commercial galleries like Marion Goodman Gallery, etc., because it's not during freeze, it's not all about the opening and the big deal and all the rest of it. So you have really interesting, slightly more thought-provoking, perhaps, shows on at this time of year when there isn't the kind of perhaps the commercial pressure and the, maybe the international audience. It can just be a wonderful show put on by a sort of blue-chip gallery, and it's really wonderful. I would urge listeners to get down to Marion Goodman in Golden Square in Soho.
I think they will do, and I also encourage you to pick up copies of both those books. They're sitting on my desk, and they're really worth thumbing through.
That Attention Service Member book, I've certainly seen that one. That's fantastic stuff. Good, I like doing these theme shows.
We'll do more. Yeah. There will be more. Let's say some goodbyes, shall we?
Yeah, that is it for edition 551 of The Monocle Weekly.
I produced today's show, and our studio managers were Maylie Evans and Louis Allen.
The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Augusta Macellari.
Thanks for tuning in.
Bye.